You're listening to The Murder in My Family, brought to you by Abject Entertainment. Be sure to check out some of the other great true crime podcasts from this network, including Missing Persons,
DNA ID,
Scene of the Crime,
Zodiac Speaking,
Beyond Bizarre True Crime,
Citizen Detective,
and
Campus Killings.
All of these podcasts are available for you to binge on right now, wherever you listen to podcasts. Subscribe where you're listening to this podcast so you don't miss an episode.
The views and opinions expressed by guests on this podcast do not necessarily represent those of the podcast, its host, or sponsors.
If you would like to discuss the murder in your family on this podcast, please be sure to visit themurderinmyfamily.com for more information.
You can support this podcast by visiting patreon.com/themurderinmyfamily. This episode may contain unsettling material or subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
Thank you for joining me for this episode of The Murder of My Family. I'm your host, Mike Morford. In this episode, we'll be discussing the case in which a family was attacked in their home by desperate criminals during a reign of terror. By the end of the chaos, two members of the family were dead and a third was seriously wounded, and the family would never be the same. We'll dive into this case after some quick housekeeping. Independent podcasts like this one depend on word of mouth to bring in new listeners. So if you find that you enjoy this show, please take a minute to rate and review it wherever you listen to your podcast, and be sure to introduce a friend to the show and invite them to listen. With your help, The Murder of My Family can continue to grow and reach a new audience. To learn more about the show or the cases we discuss, please visit themurderofmyfamily.com. You can also find us on Twitter with the handle @murderofmyfam, or by searching for The Murder of My Family podcast on Facebook. If you'd like to support this show through a Patreon donation, it's always appreciated. And you can do so by visiting patreon.com/themurderofmyfamily. Benefits of supporting the show on Patreon include early access to ad-free episodes of the show, plus bonus content not heard in regular episodes. Support may also include thank you cards, stickers, and more. If you prefer to, you can also support the show through a PayPal donation by visiting paypal.me/themurderofmyfamily. In each episode, I'll give shout-outs to any new supporters. And thank you to all the supporters that generously donate to help keep the show growing and improving. One last note. Please consider supporting any of the sponsors that you hear on The Murder of My Family, the way that those sponsors support the show. It's with our sponsor support that the show can go on and continue to provide a platform to share these stories with you in every episode. Thank you. And now on with the show. Aubrey Lee Duncan was born on July 31st, 1928, in Texarkana, Texas, to father Gabriel and mother Oma. He was given the nickname Red due to his red hair. As an adult, he was often called Dunk. After high school, Aubrey did a stint in the Navy. He met and fell in love with his wife, Nadine Dahl, and on July 11th, 1954, the couple married in California, where they would settle down and start a family. Denise Marie Duncan was the couple's first child, born February 12, 1958. The couple would go on to have three more daughters, Lynette, who's my guest in this episode, Yvonne, and Donna. Aubrey opened and ran a successful pool hall called the Q and Cushion Family Billiard Center in the city of Stanton. He also owned a small laundromat. Denise, the oldest daughter, graduated from Magnolia High School in 1975. And she was excited for the future. The Duncan family made their home in Orange County at 925 South Valera Street in Anaheim, and life was good there. Then their ideal family life was shattered by two desperate young criminals in the midst of a violent and bloody crime spree that wound up targeting Aubrey Duncan. These were two teenagers with a very troubled past and a history of breaking the law. 17-year-old Mark Wayne Titch and 18-year-old Brett Thomas had escalated from robberies to murder on December 21st, 1977. That's when a 20-year-old restaurant hostess named Laura Ann Staunton came home and interrupted the duo while they were robbing her apartment. Not wanting to leave a witness, they put her in the trunk of their car and drove her to the desert in Orange County, where one of them sexually assaulted her before shooting her with a rifle. 3 days later, on December 24th, the two young men robbed a dairy in Garden Grove and shot the store's owner, 35-year-old Ephraim Christian, to death. For the next month, Thomas and Titch evaded capture and plotted their next violent act. They decided that targeting a laundromat or a pool hall would make for good cash grab, and that's when they stumbled upon Aubrey Duncan, who owned both, and they began stalking him. At around 4 a.m. on January 29th, 1977, Aubrey arrived home after a long night at the pool hall. Although he worked late hours and handled lots of cash, he had never been robbed, but this morning would be different. He had never been robbed or had any violent encounters with anyone during his course of business, but this morning would be different. The two killers watched Aubrey as he got out of his van and headed up to his front door. He was about to put his keys in the door when Thomas ran up and shot him. Titch stole Aubrey's keys with the intention of heading back to the pool hall and letting themselves in with Aubrey's keys. Nadine Duncan was sleeping inside her home when the sound of the gunshot startled her awake. She looked out and saw her husband's car, but there was another car that she didn't recognize, with its headlights on. Nadine first suspected that teenagers were messing around with the cars, so she went to the front door and opened it. Her oldest daughter, Denise, who had also been awakened, went to the door with her, standing cautiously behind her. As Nadine opened the screen door, she saw her husband, Aubrey, lying on the ground. He was on his back with his feet on the porch and his head on the sidewalk. As she stepped onto the porch to try and aid her husband, she was shot twice and passed out. Denise, who was standing right behind her, was struck once in the heart and fell to the floor. As Nadine regained consciousness, she called out to Denise, but gunfire was the only response she got. Buckshot from a shotgun hit her right leg, and after that, Nadine was quiet and lay motionless before her attackers drove away in their car. She then crawled into the house and called for help. 17-year-old Lynette Duncan ran from her room, stepped over the bodies of her parents and her older sister Denise, and ran out of her home to the neighbors to get help, which left Yvonne alone to try and comfort her mom. Thankfully, the youngest Duncan family member, 11-year-old Donna, had been at a sleepover, and she was spared the terror of being home when the attack happened. Police and EMTs raced to the Duncan house. They determined that Aubrey Duncan was dead at the scene. Denise was barely alive, and Nadine had very serious injuries as well, and they were both rushed to the hospital. But sadly, Denise died just a few hours later. Lynette was understandably confused and shocked. She had just survived an unimaginable horror and had to see her family members dead or severely injured. But she didn't have much time before she had to break the news to friends and family about what happened at their home. And she'd also be tasked with planning two funerals, with her mom being hospitalized for several days. Thankfully, though, Denise was helped through this unimaginable task by members of her family's church, who also helped clean up the crime scene at the Duncan home. Aubrey Duncan and his oldest daughter Denise were buried together at Forest Lawn Memorial Park in Cypress, California. Although she wasn't yet an adult, Lynette was forced to grow up on that fateful morning and make decisions that would be tough for any of us at any age. Following the attack on the Duncans, police had a pretty good idea of who was responsible. After all, they had been hunting Titch and Thomas for the past month. After they left the Duncan home, Titch and Thomas drove to the pool hall, thinking that when they got inside, they would find some hoard of cash. But they were in for a letdown when the keys they stole didn't fit the door. They went over to the laundromat and were able to get inside, where they found keys to the pool hall. The two drove back to the pool hall, and Titch went up to the door while Thomas stayed in the car down the street. Titch unlocked the door, but he got spooked by a passing car and the pair fled. In the end, they didn't get a penny from the laundromat or pool hall. 3 days later, a highway patrol officer just 1 mile south of Victorville, California, saw a car parked on the shoulder of the road with its lights off. He realized the car had overheated and was still warm, but no one was around. A check of the registration revealed that the car had been stolen from Anaheim, about 80 miles southwest. A search of the highway quickly led to him discovering Titch and Thomas walking to the nearest gas station. They were arrested and the car was impounded. Officers found stolen guns in the trunk and connected the two to the murders of Laura Stoughton and Ephraim Christian, as well as the attack on the Duncan family. In court, both defendants pleaded guilty and were given multiple life sentences. But despite this, due to their ages at the time of the murders and because of California laws, they were eligible for parole just 6 years later. Thankfully, every time these two cold-blooded killers have come up for parole, it was always denied. It wasn't until many years later that Lynette, now well into adulthood, started checking back to see what the status of these two killers was. She didn't know if they were still in prison and didn't even know how or where to check, but she felt that these two needed to stay behind bars, and thankfully, Lynette found support and friends in organizations and families who had answers for her. They helped her learn how she could get involved and have a voice for her family after all that time. And she became active in the parole process, fighting to keep these two men behind bars. Titch died on April 22, 2014, in custody at San Quentin State Prison. Thomas was last denied parole in April 2015 and wasn't allowed to refile until this year. So far, Thomas isn't going anywhere, but if he comes up for parole again, Lynette will be there. Lynette is now a strong advocate for victims' rights. Her entire life had been shattered in an instant, and she was left with very lasting effects from the trauma and PTSD following the attack on her family. But there was really no one there to help her. She didn't know where to turn. Her mom, Nadine, spent 9 days in the hospital after almost being murdered, but never once saw a therapist. So you can only imagine what she dealt with. As we know in these cases, there was a ripple effect. Although the youngest three Duncan girls, along with their mom, remained in the family home following the tragedy that occurred there, the family itself was never the same. The relationships between the Duncan survivors was different. One of Lynette's sisters passed away, and sadly she doesn't have much of a relationship with the other one. Who knows how life might have been different for the Duncan family had two cold-blooded and ruthless killers not shown up on their doorstep that fateful night 45 years ago. I sat down to talk with Lynette about this horrific crime that ravaged her family, and about the aftermath, the healing, and her efforts to see two killers stay behind bars. That conversation is coming up in just a moment. Hi, Lynette, and welcome to The Murder of My Family.
Hi, Morris. How are you?
I'm very good. I'm very happy to have you here to tell this story because you've been a advocate for your family and for the justice system, I think, in general, for people that do terrible crimes and keeping them where they belong. Just a little bit of a recap, that your family's story is very tragic. It's scary. You lost not one but two of your family members. You almost lost a third. You know, that you lost your dad, Aubrey, your sister, Denise, was murdered, and you almost lost your mom, Nadine.
Correct.
It's just so much needless and senseless violence here, and obviously we're going to get into the details of what happened and how this all came about, but before we get into all that, can you just share with us a little bit about who your dad and sister were, maybe share some of your memories of them?
Oh, my dad owned a family billiard center, and I mean, he just worked all the time. My sister, well, she was, my dad was 48 when he was murdered, and my sister was just 2 weeks short of 19, and she was engaged, and, you know, she was going to college, and, you know, just had her whole life ahead of her, and, you know, we all had our whole lives ahead of us. And it affected all of us. For me, to be honest, the most lingering effect of it is the fear. When you don't feel safe in your own home, you don't feel safe anywhere. And that has just really hung on. I mean, I can't ride a city bus without being in fear. I've never ridden an Uber, and I have no intention of ever getting in the backseat of some stranger's car. It's just, I don't have what it takes to do that. But, you know, it really affects. A lot of time, in my younger years, you know, I mean, it just affects what kind of jobs I could take. I worked as a police dispatcher for, you know, a number of years, probably the worst job for me, but no one's going to murder me in the basement of the police department. And I eventually, you know, went to college and discovered prosthetics when I was 32 and went back to grad school. And that's what I do now. And no one's going to murder me there, but I could never go work at a convenience store. You know, that would just be too traumatic for me.
Yeah. And we talk a lot on the show about the ripple effect that these have and, you know, how something, you know, 45 years ago can still have lingering effects in even what jobs you take, that kind of stuff. So I think that's the takeaway here is that when something like this happens, even all those years ago, it affects the outcomes for people involved.
Yeah. And I mean, when this happened, PTSD was not a diagnosis and you didn't get therapy. This was back in 77. And, you know, the whole family just fell apart. My mom was seriously injured. She was in the hospital for 9 days. And during that time, not a single therapist came in to discuss anything with her. Mental health wasn't even considered. And so there was no one to suggest, you know, maybe staying living at the house makes sense financially, but not emotionally. So yeah, we stayed living in the house.
And not to interrupt you, but that was a question I was thinking this whole time. Did, you know, I can imagine this is a family home. You've got great memories there, but at the same time, you've got horrific memories and to stay there that, you know, I was going to ask you if you did and how long and how did you get through that?
I did a lot of, the worst part was whenever I'd go through the front door because it happened right at the front entryway and I would just go real fast into my car. I would always look out the kitchen window to make sure there was no cars over by our cars before I ever left. It was just traumatizing. And I was 17. I had no other choice. And, you know, I didn't know anyone this had ever happened to. You know, I thought I was just normal. And it wasn't until years later before I discovered PTSD. And the minute I did, it was like, oh, my God, I've got that. And I started going to therapy. And that helped greatly.
Yeah. And I like to say I can imagine, but I don't know that I can imagine what you were all going through following this, but your mom laying there in the hospital for 9 days recuperating from her injuries, and here she's witnessed this terrible event of and losing her daughter and her husband. Mm-hmm. I'm sure she could have used someone to help get her through that.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And, you know, like I said, mental health was not ever something anyone even considered. And it was just never talked about. You know, we all moved back into the house. Mom's out of the hospital. And you just never brought up the homicide. You never mentioned Dad and Denise. And then it was like to the rest of the family, it never happened. And there's no pain. And I still think about it every day. It's not like traumatizing every day, but it crosses my mind every day, almost 46 years later. And my mom, she basically checked out emotionally. And, you know, if she wasn't working at the family billiard center, she was in a room. And she came from old school where you don't cry in front of your kids. So she would just stay in the bedroom. And I knew she was sobbing in there. You know, it was just what we did. All of us, there were three daughters left, my two younger sisters and I, and we all just found other families to kind of adopt, you know, and we just kind of merged into those families. But our family really stopped being a family at that night. Sure. And it just, you know, we speak But, you know, we're not close. There's only one sister left now, and we're not close.
Yeah. And it, again, that goes back to that ripple effect of
what
things would have been different and what relationships changed and, you know, that kind of thing. It's all connected.
It is.
If you would, can you, in your own words, in your own experience, walk us through that day of how things unfolded for your family and what went down at your house?
Okay, it all started about 4 a.m. My dad was finishing his shift, and he was coming home, and these two guys, they were 17 and 18 at the time, and they decided to rob my dad of his money. But let me just go back a little bit, because these guys were spree killers. And although they had spent the last, I don't know how many years, robbing people, burglarizing homes, I mean, they would cut phone cords and then break into the homes in the middle of the night. There was a case where they grabbed a daughter out of her bedroom, drug her into the parents' room demanding money. They were vicious. For 17 and 18, they were very vicious. They had both been in and out of juvenile hall. One of them was even an escapee at that time from the juvenile system. And 9 days before, they were burglarizing a home in the town next to us. And their 22-year-old daughter came home and interrupted it. They knew one of them had had his picture taken by the police in that town, so he knew that she could ID them. They drove around, what are we going to do? She can, you know, ID us. And so they decided to kill her. And from that point on, they killed everybody. Then, like 2 days later, they were robbing a drive-thru dairy, and they killed the owner of the dairy when he was trying to help them. And then we were a few days after that. They were fortunately caught yet a few days after that, or it'd be there a lot more bodies, just a lot more. But I don't know what happened when they killed the girl, but they changed and it became a thrill kill. And by the time they killed our family, there was just gunshot all over the place. It was 4 a.m. and I woke up to gunshot. And my mom, she looked out the window to see what the noise was. And there was a car over by our cars. So she thought vandalism or something. So she got out of bed. She thought she was just going to yell at some kids. My older sister followed her out. She opened the door. She was shot. She fell back. And then my sister was shot. My sister was shot just once, but it was right in her heart. My mom was shot 3 times with the, I think it was a 45, might have been a 22, maybe it was a 22. And then when the guys left, they went to their car and they took out shotgun with birdshot and just kept blowing away at the house. So I just kept hearing all these shots, and it's 4 a.m. I had never heard gunshot in my life. My room, where it was at the time, I couldn't hear my mom and what was going on in the house, but I could hear what was going on outside. It was actually a corner of the garage. And so I could hear what was going on outside really well, all the gunshots. And when my mom heard the car drive away, she called into the house. She had to stand up to dial the operator on the wall phone. It was that long ago. It was before 911 hit California. So it was back in 77. And then my youngest sister, I have two younger sisters. One was 11, one was 14. The 14-year-old was at a sleepover at another friend's house. So she wasn't there. But the 11-year-old was. She got out, saw everything, and my mom told her to get me and then run across the street to the neighbors. So that's what Donna did. I just remember hearing Donna, the door opening up, and my mom, or my sister yelling, "Lynette, Lynette, get up. Mom, Dad, and Denise have all been shot." And then I didn't see her after that. I ran out into the house, and my mom had me get a towel to wrap her legs up in, because the dispatcher was telling her, you know, wrap your legs up in so you don't bleed out. And after I did that, I had to get out of the house to go check on Donna. And to do that, I had to walk around Denise and jump over my dad's body in the front door steps of the house. And I was just praying that I didn't miss and land in his blood. I wasn't the most athletic child. And yeah, it was just trauma. And I remember running to the neighbors and banging on their door, and they were up because they had heard the gunshot. And Donna had just, you know, after they opened the door to Donna, she just ran in to their back bedroom where they had two little girls about Donna's age. Excuse me. And they, she went back into theirs. So I ran over there. I'm just asking, is Donna okay? And they're asking, what's going on? Is Donna okay? I finally got yes. I told them that Mom, Dad, and Denise have all been shot. And they just went back out in the middle of the street and just started screaming. Mm-hmm. I remember it was a blood-curdling, low guttural scream, a scream I never want to hear come out of my soul ever again. And then there was just sirens coming from all directions. I was like in the circle and just sirens. Mm-hmm. I mean, it would be years before I could hear a siren and not have a panic attack that was happening to someone else.
That sounds like something out of a horror movie, the way this played out.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. And being 17, yeah, I had, you know, like I said, I'd never heard gunshot before. And so I'm now over at the neighbor's house, completely in shock. And I'm thinking, well, there's a lot of places you could be shot and still survive. I think everyone's going to be fine. And anyone who saw my dad at least would know that he was no longer with us. Denise was actually unconscious and died an hour and a half later in the hospital. And it was, like I said, a different time. There was no Office of Victim Services. There was no team that comes out. I mean, now you get, you know, a chaplain, and you get therapists and the therapy dog, you know, you get everybody comes out to help the victim. And it just wasn't that way. And the cops set me aside and told me my dad and sister didn't make it, but my mom's going to be just fine. And I'm being 17 and just trying to process this. And I'm thinking, you know, I'm doing actually better than I expect. And then he said the one thing that shocked the crap out of me. He goes, "Now go in that back bedroom and tell your little sister." You know, on the day I die and I look back on my life, that will still be the hardest thing I've ever done. And I've done some hard things, but telling her, no, that was, no one should ever have to be in that position. And I remember walking down the hallway and going to the back bedroom, and I saw her two little friends, but I didn't see Donna. And I asked them, "Is Donna here?" And they just pointed to the bedroom closet. She was in a fetal position in the bedroom closet, the furthest from the boogeyman that she could get. Mm-hmm. Years later, she would write her victim impact statement to one of the parole hearings. And she started it with, "That's the night I realized that monsters were real, and daddies don't always kill them." Hmm. Just breaks your heart. And for a long time, I have always said, that's the day we discovered the boogeyman was real. And it's interesting because we had never talked about that. And it wasn't until we each wrote our own victim impact statement years later for one of their parole hearings. And you know, it was interesting how we both felt the same way about it. But like I said, Mom ended up in the hospital for 9 days, and that was back when you buried them right away. And so I had to plan the funeral. I had our clergy person, you know, help with that, which made things so much easier. And it was before they even had companies that clean crime scenes. So the men from our church volunteered to come and clean the crime scene. It was before AIDS, before, you know, it's a bloodborne pathogen anyway. But yeah, it was horrendous. And they had to patch all the walls because of all the bullet holes. And for years, there were still big chunks of brick out of the front facade on the porch where, you know, it just shot up.
How do you, your mom gets out of the hospital, you know, you've laid your dad and your sister to rest. Was there some kind of family meeting? Did you get together at some point and say, okay, we're going to get through this and here's what we're going to do? I mean, how do you even start to move forward after that?
I remember my two sisters and I went and visited Mom, and it was probably a couple days later, maybe even that day. You know, she was out of surgery. I remember we went in and we're all telling her, we don't want to go back to the house. And she's saying, we have to go back to the house, girls. We have to go back. And my mom didn't do well with change. And I think that was about the most amount of change anyone could ever do in a, you know, should have to even do in a lifetime. And financially, it didn't make sense. You know, I mean, the pool hall, we kind of, you know, survivors certainly weren't wealthy, and it was just down the street from the house, and we wouldn't be able to sell the house for anywhere near what it was worth because major homicide just happened there. So, you know, I mean, it was just what we did, and then we just didn't discuss it. I do remember walking into the house the first time. It had been it'd been a few days because we all ended up staying with other friends for a while. The police had their, you know, stuff they had to do. And so finally it was, I think the day before the funeral, I had a bunch of relatives that had come in and everyone was meeting at the house. And that was the first day back in. And by now the crime scene had been cleaned up. The walls had all been patched up and painted. And it was so hard getting over that front doorstep. It took everything I could. But once I got in, then I was able to remember a lot of happier memories. And I'm kind of glad we did go back in at least, because if we hadn't, all I would have remembered from my whole childhood, I think, would have been that night, that I was able to pull up some of the better memories. A lot of relatives were there. We were able to laugh and cry and hug. And then eventually you just move back in and try to
pick up the pieces.
Go on. Uh-huh. Yeah. But there was no help picking up the pieces.
Let's turn the page to the next chapter, because you mentioned these two scumbags are, you know, captured. This is Brett Matthew, Paul Thomas, and Mark Wayne Titch. Two guys that, as you mentioned, just had really bad backgrounds and not good people. You had to face the next chapter of going through the court proceedings. How much, you know, as a younger person back then, did you get involved in that? Did you go to the court proceedings? Did your mom go to them? And how tough was that to go through all that stuff?
Yeah. Well, my mom wouldn't let me go because, you know, she had to testify. And so her excuse is, I have school. And There was just a preliminary hearing. Mom testified at that. And after the preliminary hearing, when the trial was about to start and the jury had all been picked, the two guys decided at the very last minute to plead guilty. I really don't know why, because it was before they had capital punishment and it was before they had life without parole. So that's why they still got, they got a life sentence, but they had parole hearings. The same reason that Manson used to get his parole hearings before he died, because that just happened at a different time in California history. So I had never saw them. I saw their picture in the paper, and that was it. Mm-hmm. They pled guilty. In fact, interesting story, years later, when I was in town for one of the parole hearings, one of the local newspaper top crime reporter had gotten involved in the parole hearings and covering us for the parole hearings, at least me. And he was able to introduce me to this judge, actually. He was working on a case, and, you know, I was in town, so he invited me in to talk to this judge. And turned out the judge, 34 years previously, when he was right out of law school, he was a court-appointed defense attorney to one of the guys. I'm not sure which one it was.
Wow.
But he told me that he still remembered that case. And in all of his years in law, and it's been a lot of years, like I said, he's now a judge, is that it is the only time he had ever, pled out. That's it. The only time he had ever pled someone out to first-degree murder, and he was glad to do it. He goes, we had no defense. And he goes, you'll look in their eyes and there was just nothing. There was no soul there. So, so they pled to first degree murder. You know, they could have probably pled out to something less, but they both agreed to plead out to first degree murder. And their first parole hearing was in 6 years after that, which I just found out about by reading the paper one day.
Which is crazy that they could be up for parole that quick.
In 6 years, yeah. And then it turned out every 2 years after that, until, like I said, we were at the 34-year mark. It was about 12 years ago. And in a strange roundabout way, I discovered how to find out that they were still incarcerated. I do prosthetic limbs for amputees, had a patient, and it turned out him and his wife had gone through a similar crime a few years earlier. And we were talking, and they told me about a homicide survivor support group that had just started in that town. And their second meeting was that night. And it was like a mile and a half from my house. I was back in Maryland at the time. I left California years ago and never wanted to move back. So I'm like, I could go to this? They go, yes, you can. So I went to it that night. And I told my story. And they asked, well, are they still incarcerated? And I said, well, I don't know. And they were like completely in shock. Because everyone in that room, and there was like six of them, they had all had gone through when there was an Office of Victim Services and you had rights. And they go, what do you mean you don't know? And I said, I don't even know how to find out. Oh, we will teach you how to find out. So they told me about the VINE program, which is Victims something or other. And they had it was completely online. And so the next morning, my computer wasn't working at the time. So the next morning I get to work and I type in the VINE thing and they want to know what county jail they were in. But they're not in the county jail. So I call up the 800 number that was listed and they said, oh yeah, it was California at that time. They're now involved in the prison system. But at that time they weren't. And they go, but here's the number to the prison. Okay, great. Which prison? Which prison are you even giving me the number for? I'm expecting a switchboard operator going, okay. So I decide to call the number, and it actually happened to be the victim services for the whole prison system. I didn't know that existed. And I left my information because it was 6 a.m. their time, 9 my time, because California and Minnesota time difference. So I but they had a website, and I looked it up, and they said on the website, this big, like a pop-up ad came up, and they had just started this victim locator or inmate locator where I could type in like the victim's name or their name or something, and I could find out. And I typed them both in, just kind of held my breath each time, because I just assumed they had been paroled long ago. And they were both still incarcerated and had been the whole time. And I'm like, oh, my God, I could breathe. Uh-huh. Well, noon comes along. Now it's 9 o'clock California time. And I get a call back from Victim Impact and from the victim services. And I found out that, yes, they're both incarcerated, but one of them is coming up for a parole hearing. I'm like, oh, my God, I could go to that, can't I? Yes, you can. I can give a victim impact statement, can't I? Yes, you can. Long story short, I ended up flying out, and they found out I was going to be there, or this, the one guy, found out that I was going to be there. This was Thomas, Brett Thomas. And so he fired the state's attorney, hired outside counsel, got the whole thing postponed. That's okay. I played cat and mouse for a while. And when I finally faced him down, I mean, it had been, by that time, I think 36 years. And I'm 10 feet from him in this room, terrified, but I had a crate support group from Barcy's Law for All, which is a victims' rights organization. And they helped me out. And I am, when I walked out of that prison, out of the room to give the victim impact statement after his parole hearing, and he got a 5-year denial, I tell you, I was different. I was no longer a victim. I was a survivor. And I found out my voice had power, and I had power, and victims have power now. And it was tremendous. It was so healing. Yeah. And, yeah, I recommend everyone stand up for yourself. It's huge.
And it's good that you have that support system of people to give you advice and say, hey, you can this, you can do that. Yeah.
Well, you know, it's interesting because if I was alone, I don't know if I would have had the guts to walk into the prison, because when you're there, you have to sign a form saying that you understand if you're abducted, they will not negotiate for your release. And I'm like, oh my God, but I've got all these people here. I've come all this way. Let's just go forward. But I was traumatized. But it worked out really well. And the last parole hearing we just had with this guy, this time he didn't even show up. Decided not to show up. And I'm like, okay.
Maybe he sort of just assumed, okay, it's a formality, but I'm not getting out of here.
Yeah. Maybe that's what he told. Yeah. He told his defense attorney that they're not going to let me out anyway, so I'm not going to go. Because we've done 3 of these now. And, the first two, after playing cat and mouse, he's not getting out. The first one, he had all of these, he had this big notebook, this 3-ring binder that had all these book reports from Bible studies that he has done. And I mean, yeah, like I said, a high-priced attorney that specialized in getting people, on parole. And I mean, he had letters written from all these people, a lot of them prisoners. But the average amount of time that a lifer spends incarcerated is 34 years. And we were right at that 34-year mark. So no one had ever come to his parole hearings before. He was really expecting to get out. And now I show up. And
threw a monkey wrench into his trouble.
Oh, I sure did. The next Pearl Herring, I was a little more prepared, and this time I had two notebooks with me. And I opened up those notebooks. These are everything my dad and sister had done since he's been incarcerated, and they were just empty notebooks. Yeah, so that kind of surprised them.
That's also a powerful statement to say, hey, here's, you know, my notebooks of what they've done, and there's nothing in them. Really paints a picture of what he took.
Yeah. And also with the first one, since he ended up backing out at the last minute and, like I said, firing the state's attorney, I was able to find out from the prosecutor that, hey, I could get a copy of this police report. I was a juvenile at the time. You know, mom didn't want one. And so I didn't know it still even existed. And I was able to get a copy. And I was also able to get photos. I wanted crime photos because I wanted to show up at the parole hearing with a picture of what the crime scene looked like so that he couldn't say the gun accidentally went off. I wanted the commissioners to know how violent it was. And what was interesting is, so the sergeant, I mean, they had a hard time finding the police report. The police department did. And they finally found it. And the sergeant called me up, who does homicides. And he said, you know, I've got these photos and they are very graphic. And do you want me to just leave those off? And I told him, you know, there's nothing he could show me or that I could see in those photos that I don't clearly still remember all these years later. And so he sent them. And what was interesting is looking at them, I had another healing moment. I mean, I spent quite a few years really messed up. I shouldn't be functional. I am, but I shouldn't be. But yeah, things were not as good as they should have been, let's just say, for a number of years until I really started doing some healing. And so I'm looking at this photo, and all of a sudden how old was I? I was like 50 at the time. And I was now a 50-year-old woman. And I'm like seeing like a, it was like I'm looking high and looking down at this whole crime scene. And I, in my mind, and I could see 17-year-old me jumping over this body. I mean, the pictures were a lot worse than my mind had remembered, to be honest. And I could see the 17-year-old me jumping over their bodies, running to the middle of the street, screaming in the middle of the street. And all I wanted to do was hug that 17-year-old me and say, well, no wonder, it's not your fault. It's not your fault you were messed up for a few years. Hmm. And that was just, that being able to forgive myself was just huge.
Hmm. So now one of these two killers died in prison, but there's still one that could potentially someday get out. I'm curious, did either of them ever show any kind of remorse or maybe write your family a letter and say, I'm sorry we did this. You know, I wish we could change it. Was there any of that, any remorse?
Interesting you should ask. The first parole hearing, the lawyer said that he had written a letter, you know, saying how sorry he was. And it's like, well, wait a minute, we have not received this. The, you know, Office of Victim Services has my address now. And she said, well, he wrote it. And it's like, you know, to this day, I still have not received it. He has never come out. This is Brett Thomas. He had never come out with any reason why. Because there is no reason why. I mean, there is absolutely no excuse. They knew how to ask for money. They had been robbing people for years. So, like I said, I think it was a thrill kill. Now, there was another a girlfriend of mine, she was trying to write a book about it. It's never gotten done, let's put it that way. But she wrote to Mark Titch before Mark Titch died in prison. And he wrote a letter to me. A lot of it was, I'm trying to think now. I mean, a lot of it was, you know, blaming it all on Brett Thomas and, you know, whatever. There wasn't a lot of, you know, like I said, he mostly blamed the other guy, although they were both there shooting. So, you know,
maybe
neither of them were innocent.
Oh, yeah. Maybe
I think
two psychopaths
got together. I was going to say, I think two psychopaths got together and things really escalated.
And they fed off each other probably. And
oh, yeah. Mm. And like I said, they would have still, there would have been a higher body count had they not been caught.
Yeah, it definitely seems like that would be a possibility. There's just no, you know, the rage that they displayed is just, it's frightening. And what's really frightening about this whole story is, just it could have been anyone, you know.
Exactly.
It just happened to be your family that day, but that's what's scary. Anyone out there,
and the other two families,
and the other families, that's very frightening. And I'm, you know, hopefully he stays in prison where he belongs. And I'm glad you found your voice and your strength to sort of be an advocate and, you know, for your family. I'm curious. You know, I don't want to wrap up this conversation talking about them. I want to sort of turn it to something positive again. Let's just say there's someone out there who's going through a terrible ordeal, maybe like your family went through, and you've, you know, 45 years later, you're improving and getting stronger and surviving all this. What advice would you have for someone else out there that's maybe going through something similar to what you went through?
Yeah, get therapy. There are so many different types of therapy now that really do work. Start off, really get therapy. Don't just ignore it. Don't say, hey, I'm not physically hurt, so I'm fine. Get therapy. Join homicide survivor support groups. There's a number of them out there. And most communities have one nearby, which is sad state of our affairs that we have to have so many, you know, homicide survivor support groups. But they're amazing to go and know that you are not alone. For years, I thought I was the only one really feeling this way because my family never talked about it. You don't talk about it with people. People don't come up to you and say, yeah, man, this really bothered me. But when I found out about the parole hearing, first thing I did was I went on Facebook, and most of my friends on Facebook were all from high school. And I said, you guys, I need your help. This guy's up for parole. I want to really inundate them with a lot of letters saying, well, we don't want him to come out. This is the chance we have, you know, and all these people just came out of the woodwork and said, you know, that bothered my family too. My family moved from the neighborhood after that. I mean, just so many people were finally able to feel open enough to talk to me because, you know, there's no book on, no instructions on how to deal with this when, especially when you're in high school. And, you know, I have a few people who said, I know how you feel. I remember when my dog died. You know, well, thank you. It's not the same.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I got that when my grandfather died. Yeah, he was 97. Yeah, not the same. So all of a sudden, I was able to talk to people about what I was going through to find out they went through it all too. A lot of them were still traumatized by it. And it just felt amazing to not be alone. And so I just recommend really joining a support group, getting the therapy that you need. And there's no weakness in getting therapy. I remember my mom used to always tell me that I was the only one who had any problems with it because I'm the only one who went to therapy. And that was in my 30s, you know. And so when we first found out that the guy was going to be on parole, and it was Christmas week that he was going to be on parole, you know, December 28th, that was the parole hearing. So I called my mom and my two younger sisters, and I said, hey, can you guys drive? They were all in Orange County, California at the time. Can you drive the 2 hours to San Diego to the prison and give a victim impact statement? And I got three no's. And the only one that really made sense to me was the one who was 11 at the time, because we finally talked about it. And she just started sobbing to me saying, but if you go, they'll know who you are and they'll get out anyway, and then they'll come and kill you. I mean, you're talking real fear. She was in her 40s at the time, still that frightened. And I mean, I'm just sobbing to me, I can't allow them to control me anymore. My life is, you know, they've controlled me way too long. And it was really good. Eventually, she was able to write her victim impact statement. But, you know, when I went to, flew out for the parole hearing, and that's after I flew out was when they decided, or he decided he was going to cancel. So I was able to at least visit my mom and one of my sisters. And I remember I told my mom, I go, I never want to hear you again say that I'm the only one that had a problem with this because I'm the only one who went to therapy. It's because I went to therapy that I could go there to the prison and I could look him in the eye, I could face him down, and I could stand up for this family, for Dad and Denise and myself, and keep him incarcerated. About a month after that, I was talking to my mom on the phone, and completely out of the blue, she said, I'm so proud of you for getting well. And that was just huge, absolutely huge to me. And I said, you know, Mom, therapy will help you too. I know, but I'm not doing it. Okay.
No.
Never did go to therapy. Never even read my victim impact statement. Yeah. We have a victim impact statement from her that was read to the commissioners, but I wrote it. I just, wrote it in first person for her. And this is something that I tell my patients all the time too, who have, spent 2 years trying to heal a wound and lose their limb anyway. And I truly believe this, but everyone goes through hell in their life and it makes you who you are. And I like the person I've become. I wouldn't be this without it. I don't wish it on anyone else. I wish I had a much less trial to like the person I am, but I do like the person I've become. And it's a lot of it is because of this.
Uh-huh. Well, again, I think it's all, evidence that you can overcome something very, very traumatic and very frightening and tragic the way this was. And again, thank you so much for coming on and sharing your story with us.
No problem. Thank you for allowing me.
Thank you once again for joining me for this episode of The Murder of My Family. I'd like to thank Sunny Landon for writing and research assistance in this episode. We'll be back here soon with an all-new episode of The Murder of My Family, and I hope you'll join me for it. But before you go, remember that every murder victim means something to somebody.